Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at this the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Excellent. Doing great.
I'm very excited about our program this evening and really this whole series that we're kicking off this evening.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to the Foresight 2010 conference with the next couple of shows. And actually, are we going to do two shows on this, or three, or what's the plan now?
We've got three shows lined up. We've got two guests this evening who will be speakers at the conference. Two guests lined up next week who are speakers at the conference. The following week, we've got Jay Storrs Hall lined up, and possibly another speaker from the conference. So we've got at least three weeks of programs leading right up to Foresight 2010, which is going to be Saturday, January 16th and Sunday, January 17th, 2010 at the Sheraton Palo Alto Hotel in Palo Alto, California. It's a tremendous event. We'll be getting into some additional details on that, and of course we'll be providing links both at Blog Talk Radio and at The Speculist that you can follow, get more information about the conference, and we hope that everyone listening who at all can possibly make it will show up for Foresight 2010.
Well, I got an email today from Christine Peterson who says that today's the last day to get the super early discount rate, and so those in our audience who are interested in signing up, I'd encourage you to go on and check it out. I mean, like right now.
And, okay, well, that's timely news. Okay, so I know that the 2-day conference rate is $175. Don't know what the super early rate is. Follow the links, folks. If you're listening, if you think you want to go, now's your time. Let's get signed up for Foresight 2010.
Well, let's bring out our guests.
Okay, let's get going.
Okay, tonight we have with us Michael Anisimov, who is a science technology writer and consultant. He's the creative force behind one of my favorite blogs, Accelerating Future. I link to him and steal your ideas as often as possible, Michael. He is a co-founder of the Immortality Institute and the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and we are very grateful and glad to have you on the show tonight.
Hey, Stephen, and Phil, and Ralph, too.
Welcome back to Fast Forward Radio, Michael. It's always a pleasure having you on. Our next guest is Ralph Merkel. Ralph received his Ph.D. from Stanford University in 1979, where he was the co-inventor of public key cryptography. He joined Xerox PARC in 1988, where he pursued research in security and computational nanotechnology until 1999. He was a nanotechnology theorist at Zybex until 2003, when he joined the Georgia Institute of Technology as a professor of computing until 2006. He is a director at Alcor, and he's on the faculty of Singularity University and a co-founder of the Nanofactory Collaboration and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Molecular Manufacturing. He was a co-recipient of the 1998 Feynman Prize for Nanotechnology for Theory, the ACM's Canalacus Award, I hope I didn't do that badly, for Theory and Practice, and the IEEE Kobayashi Award and the 2000 RSA Award in Mathematics. Ralph has 14 patents, has published extensively, and has given hundreds of talks. Ralph Merkel, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, we're honored to have both of you gentlemen on our program this evening. We thought it would be fun leading up to Foresight 2010 to have some of the folks who will be part of the program, who will be speaking at the conference, and maybe give a little bit of a feel for what the conferences like. We talk about it quite a bit on this show. I'm a big believer in that particular event. Got me started in all of this future directed stuff was the Foresight Conference in 2003, and we just hope that folks listening will get a feel for what's going to be happening, get some interest, and hopefully they'll also want to attend Foresight 2010. So why don't we start off with just a very basic question about what the conference is and why should people think about attending the Foresight Conference? And Ralph, we'll just throw that one to you initially.
Well, the conference basically is a discussion of what's going on in nanotechnology and more broadly in technologies that are of interest to the Foresight community, which includes not only nanotechnology but also artificial intelligence and a range of other technologies that are exploding exponentially. And we're going to be having speakers in a variety of areas. Obviously, I'll be speaking. We'll also be having speakers who will be discussing some of the experimental work, some of the theoretical work that's going on, how it is that atoms are arranged. I should probably mention that the Foresight conferences have been going on since 1989, so there's a really long track record. And the Foresight conferences have been bringing the concepts of nanotechnology and the concepts of advances in technology to a very wide audience for all of that time period, and really have been very well received. I think the feedback we get from the conferences is just excellent. People love them. They enjoy them. They also particularly enjoy the opportunity not simply to listen to people who are talking about the areas they're excited about and the areas that are going to be transforming humanity, but also the opportunity to talk with other people who are interested in these areas and the opportunity to exchange ideas informally while they are there and to generally have a good time.
So it's as much about what goes on between the speaking sessions as what goes on in the sessions. Is that a fair thing to say?
Conferences are always about what goes on between the speaking sessions. One of the great opportunities of the conference is an opportunity to network, an opportunity to talk with people, to renew old acquaintances, and to talk with new people who you haven't met before and are doing interesting things.
Absolutely. Michael, how about you? Thoughts on the value of the Foresight Conference? Anything you'd like to add to what Ralph had to say?
Well, first of all, I share with you that I got involved in 2003. Initially, it was the first time I went to a Foresight Conference, but I actually read about Eric Drexler and Foresight. Eric Drexler is one of the founding fathers of nanotechnology, along with Ralph. I read in Nano by Ed Regis, a science journalist, about the Foresight Institute when I was 12, so that was 13 years ago. And ever since then, I've just been fascinated by these ideas. And attending a Foresight conference was like my first real, like, deep exposure in person to all the people talking about these ideas, and it was really a transformative experience. And the organization that I work for now, Singularity Institute, actually grew out of discussions at Foresight conferences. So if it weren't for Foresight conferences, there probably wouldn't be such a thing as a Singularity Institute, and I'd probably be working somewhere else, maybe doing something a lot less interesting.
Well, there you go. That's really interesting that you mentioned that book, Nano. You know, I read that when it first came out, too, and that sort of led me to eventually reading Engines of Creation, which we just did 3 weeks – no, I'm sorry, two weeks ago. So when did we talk about it? Was it just last week we were doing that? I'm an old man. I
remember. having a senior moment. I think it was the week before last, actually.
Week before last. Recently, we were talking about that book and kind of working our way through portions of that book. And, yeah, that led me to the Foresight event myself. Now, I have to admit one thing, though, is that when I first read Nano, I was older than 12. So just the way that stuff works out. Keeping with just what it has kind of spawned, which is kind of interesting. How would you say that, Michael? How would you say that the Foresight Conference compares to other events that are of interest to listeners of Fast Forward Radio, people who read Accelerating Future or The Speculist? How would you compare it to the Singularity Summit or to the recent H+ gathering or those kinds of events? What's similar and what's different about the Foresight Conference?
Well, let's see. One of the things I really like about the Foresight conferences is that I consider them to be at an ideal size, where maybe I'd say approximately like 200 or 300 people will attend, maybe even less actually, where it's large enough that there's a huge number of people who are really interesting available to talk to, but it's small enough where you get kind of like a personal feel, and you will sort of be passing the same people in the halls again and again and hearing them in other conversations, and sort of so you can get a feel for other people, and you might approach and talk to someone because you've been exposed to them several times that you wouldn't at a huge conference where everyone's more anonymous. And that's kind of what the Singularity Summit has become, where there's approximately 800 to 1,000 people at these conferences. So it's an important conference where there's a lot of really good ideas being thrown around, but you just don't get that level of personal interaction that you would at a Foresight event. And the other thing about Foresight is that it's an interesting look at the synergy between our community and Silicon Valley itself, because it's been a conference that's consistently been in Silicon Valley year after year. So the crowd of people at Foresight conferences has somewhat mirrored like the background of people in Silicon Valley. So if you are not from the area, by visiting a Foresight conference, you won't only get a taste of nanotechnology and futurism and the leaders in those areas, but you'll also get a taste of the modern-day thinking in the Silicon Valley culture, which is always interesting to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, Ralph, do you have anything to add to that? I mean, I know that you've attended these other conferences as well. I mean,
no, that is a very good description. I think one of the things is that the group of people who are interested in future events tend to go to several conferences, and there tends to be significant overlap in the membership. The differing emphases of the different conferences are of course very distinctive. You have obviously more focus on the artificial intelligence and some of the AI conferences. Other conferences will focus more on the sort of the far out aspects. And the Foresight conferences, I think when it started, Foresight was all of those things, and now gradually we've been seeing a growth of a range of conferences that people have been going to.
Okay.
I wonder, with your connection to Singularity University, how would you compare the Foresight conference with what goes on there?
Well, Singularity University is primarily focused on having an intensive 9 or 10 week summer session, and also executive sessions scattered throughout the year. And that's more an in-depth immersion into all of the exponential technologies, including, of course, nanotechnology. Nanotechnology being one of the tracks at Singularity University. And those, there's a website, so obviously if people are interested in hearing what's going on at Singularity University, I would strongly recommend Googling it and browsing around. Some of the videos are up on the web. I have to confess, all modesty aside, there is a video of myself talking about an introduction to molecular nanotechnology, which is in fact excellent, so I would recommend it highly. And if you go to Singularity University and look over the videos, you'll find that I'm one among many actually excellent videos that are providing introductions and commentary on a number of exponential technologies.
Well, since we've talked about these things, Stephen, we should be sure and include a link to Singularity University in our show notes, as well as to the most recent Singularity Summit, where I think there are also additional resources that people can pull down and look at, get a feel for some of what goes on at these. So let's talk a little about what's going to be going on at Foresight 2010. Now, the overarching theme of the conference, as I understand it, is something we've been talking about here on this program for the last few weeks. This convergence of artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. Just to kind of get us going with that, Ralph, what's that all about? Why talk about those two topics together?
Well, obviously, if we're looking at what kinds of technology are going to have the largest impact on the future, the two that immediately come to mind, the two that are going to have a big impact, are going to be artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. Let me put it this way. There are two things that seem to be really important in the universe. One of them is the material substance, the atoms, the molecules. and the sort of structural building blocks, and the other is how they are arranged, the architecture, the way in which that matter is going to be dealing with and interacting with the world, how it is that our minds, our intelligences, the minds of computers, how it is these phenomena emerge from the physical structure. So if you have an ability to understand the architecture, the arrangement, the information of what's going on, the intelligence, and if you also understand the physical underpinnings, how atoms are arranged, and the possible ways in which you can arrange atoms, the opportunities that are available to us in terms of how we arrange those atoms, if you understand those two things, then you have understood a large part of where technology is going and the kind of contributions that technology can make. And I think that's kind of the focus of the whole conference, which is the synergy of these two things. The two things themselves are crucial. Together, they seem to encompass pretty much all of the things we regard as of major importance and value.
Well, of the two things, artificial intelligence and nanotech, is there one that's going to be the chicken and the other the egg, or they just contribute to one another as they grow, or what are we looking at there?
You know, that's a subject that gets debated long into the night at various conferences. Obviously, if we have major advances in artificial intelligence, if we have computers that are able to understand and think and reason, they could then start moving nanotechnology forward much more rapidly. They could start to be used in the research laboratory and in the development process to expand our ability to arrange and rearrange molecular structure. On the other hand, nanotechnology, because it lets us do a better and better job of building computers, will provide better and better hardware, which in its turn will accelerate anything based on computers, will accelerate artificial intelligence and machine intelligence. So which of those comes first, or whether there's some combined pathway where both of them help the other, it's a little bit hard to say. It's clear, though, that both of those are coming at us in the next few decades. I mean, obviously, any of our listeners who expect to be living in, 20 or 30 years from now, you can expect major changes in the world and in how we interact with it from the developments in both of these areas.
Michael, between the two technologies, there's these pathways, one contributing to the other. Is one jumping to your mind as we speak?
Not really. I mean, I think that it's still a toss-up which one will lead to the other, and as Ralph says, like, this is debated at great length, but there was, like, another duality that came to mind when Ralph was explaining AI and nanotech, which is that of merely thinking and doing. I think that a lot of the scenarios that involve AI equivalent or surpassing the human level usually involve some scenario where the AI accelerates nanotechnology development and is able to change the world or facilitate human decisions about changing the world much more rapidly than we've ever been capable of doing. So right now, it seems like these two technologies are relatively separate. So I know, like, there's a lot of talk about convergence, but it's also worth mentioning that it's possible that they will proceed fairly separately up until there's, like, a real powerful breakthrough. Like, for instance, nanofactories would be a breakthrough that could lead to nanocomputing, which could then lead to AI. Even if we didn't know about the underlying principles of intelligence, it might be that nanotechnology will allow us to scan the human brain in enough detail to run it in a computer, which is one of those, like, last-ditch plausibility arguments for AI. Like, if we don't figure out the inner workings of intelligence on a theoretical level, then we can just mindlessly copy it, and that's another thing that leads to endless debate. But none of them really jumps out at me. I think that they both are most likely 20 or so years off, maybe a little less, probably maybe a little more. And I've spent a few sleepless nights actually wondering whether the transition of one to the other will be as smooth as I initially thought. Because when I was initially exposed to any of these ideas, I was only thinking about the upsides. Now as I've gained a lot more knowledge in these areas, I've started to think about the ways in which the transition between one and the other could be more chaotic or sloppy.
And that's an interesting portion of what goes on at a conference like Foresight 2010 as well, is that there's time to get into that, and I haven't actually read through the list of topics. I'm actually not even sure it's been published yet, but as far as what everyone's talking about, I'm sure that there will be as much discussion of potential downsides and risks as there is the big aha benefits that we're looking for from these kinds of technologies. Now, I'll note that in our chat room, we have one vote for hardware before software. Nanotechnology will come first, AI sometime later. So I'm going to counter that vote with no. I think AI is going to come first, and then the AI will show us how to do nanotech. But it's interesting that that if you look within a time frame, you can say, well, we know that we're going to have developments, improvements in the nanotechnology. We're going to have improvements in how we're doing artificial intelligence, and we definitely see that there's going to be a relationship evolving between the two. But the big prediction as to which comes first, I got to say, guys, a little disappointed. I didn't get a definite nanotech from Ralph and a definite artificial intelligence from Michael. That's really what
I'd
want.
I'd like AI to come first, but that doesn't mean it'll happen.
Okay, fair enough. Here's another question from the chat room, and I'll throw this one to you, Ralph. What breakthrough will get the average person excited about nanotechnology or artificial intelligence? What's on the horizon that we can expect to see here in the next few years that is really going to get people's attention, create a good deal more awareness of these technologies, and actually make the kind of average person more interested in this?
Well, I think basically the big one, of course, is advances in computer hardware and computer technology. Of course, we tend to be rather blasé about that. We know that Moore's Law has been operating for quite a long time. We know we're going to see a doubling of the computer power every year or two going into the future. So that's sort of baked into the cake. And yet, when we look at that, extrapolation of the future, it gets pretty hard to do in the next decade or two. And one of the things nanotechnology will provide, one of the things that's going to have a major value, is the ability to continue that computer hardware revolution. Of course, having said that, the next thing that people are always interested in are the medical capabilities that will be available. Right now, people have this bad habit of getting unhealthy. You know, people grow old, they have various illnesses, various diseases, and at a fundamental level, disease and ill health are caused by damage at the cellular and even the molecular level. And yet today, our ability to deal with damage at that level is simply very, very limited. In the future, with nanotechnology, we'll have molecular tools, tools that have the finesse, the precision to deal with those kinds of structures, and we'll have them at low cost and in large numbers, so we'll be able to heal, we'll be able to cure in cases that in decades past would simply have been hopeless. So
well,
those are two of the possibilities that I think people point to most frequently. And, of course, there are others if you want me to keep rattling on.
Well, we'd love to have you rattle on all evening, actually, but it is an hour show, so I'm gonna toss the question over to Michael, maybe on the artificial intelligence side, having seen a couple of possibilities from the nanotech side.
You're talking about future possibilities?
Yeah, we're talking about
right.
Things that are likely to come up in the next few years that will capture the imagination of the public around these technologies.
Well, let's see. AI is really unpredictable, but one area that seemed as if it was going to be moving forward but never really bore too much fruit is the idea of facial recognition being run on massive amounts of video. We're finally getting to the point where it's possible to buy enough storage space to hold tens of thousands of hours of video, and there's people who have indeed begun filming their entire lives, and I think there are a few people that have even begun storing everything that they see. I know I've spoke to Steve Mann, who's been a pioneer in this area, where he wears these goggles that film everything he does, and he has these funny anecdotes where there's been scenarios where he like sees a car crash and then is referred to as a witness because he has like video of that car crash or stuff like that. So what I think AI could play into this is the idea of there being a massive public database of shared video, and not, which is somewhat like YouTube, but more video that would be considered useless today, because video that has long spots of blank periods, like several hours of blank period and then maybe 10 minutes of activity, using like AI that might be possible to develop like within the next 5 years, it's already becoming possible to automatically select out the points of video that are of interest to people viewing it. So we'll be able to deal with a lot more data, and also that will push forward the phenomenon of transparency, which we've been seeing, which is where it's getting harder and harder to hide. So say like someone's on the run from like London to San Francisco to New York, well, if their face can be recognized by these AIs that are viewing video from like banks and other buildings, random places that contribute footage, then it might be much more difficult to hide, and that circumstance could have positive and negative effects.
Okay. Well, I think that that is definitely a possibility we're looking for. I guess I was kind of looking for the, you know, AI love bot or something like that. You know, really going to grab people. Although going back just for a minute, Ralph, to medicine, I want to spring an analogy on you that we came up with either last week or the week before when we were talking about we were reflecting on engines of creation and talking about the transition that is to come when true molecular nanotechnology shows up. And I think in a certain sense, when we really do have molecularly precise technology, we're going to look back at our current era with a certain amount of either disdain or just kind of pity in terms of what we were able to do. And my analogy is that we'll look back on these days and we'll say, basically, we were trying to do all the medicine, all the practices of medicine with hammers. That's all we had was a hammer, and we were just kind of pounding on bodies trying to make something happen. Do you think that's is that a fair analogy?
Well, I think that's certainly something like what's going to happen. I mean, we look back today on medieval medicine and we're horrified. There was a marvelous statement in one of the Star Trek episodes where Bones McCoy said, "Don't leave him in the hands of 20th century medicine." And the idea was that medical technology in the future is in fact going to be a lot better. Doctors in the future will be able to do a lot more for the patient. Let me just give you one example so you have some feel for the kind of thing we're talking about. Today, if you suffer a heart attack, you're going to collapse fairly rapidly, and that's not a good thing. The primary problem, of course, is that when you have a heart attack, the circulation fails, the oxygen levels in the tissue fall rapidly, the metabolism ceases to function. If we have the ability to distribute some sort of oxygen-bearing device, that would have a big impact. And of course, for the readers who know what I'm, the listeners who know what I'm talking about, I'm discussing the respirocyte. The basic idea here is that we could have a device that would be perhaps a micron in size that would hold compressed oxygen, and we would be able to inject a therapeutic dose of some millions or billions of these devices. They would circulate throughout the body, and they would carry oxygen. And in fact, if you do the quantitative analysis, you find they can carry over 100 times as much oxygen as ordinary red blood cells. And as a consequence, if you injected a therapeutic dose of these devices, you'd be able to do a couple of remarkable things. One of them, of course, is you could hold your breath for an hour. You could sit at the bottom of a swimming pool and just sort of sit there and contemplate nature. Or, as I mentioned earlier, if you had a heart condition or if you were subject to heart attacks and you'd had a therapeutic dose of these injected on a preventive basis, then if you actually had a heart attack, when you stopped breathing, these artificial red blood cells, these respirocytes, would then take over the distribution of oxygen. They would be able to release oxygen into the tissues because, obviously, if they're already distributed throughout your circulatory system. They're already in place. They can release oxygen into the tissues, and they can absorb the carbon dioxide. So you could sustain your tissues, you could sustain your metabolism for an hour or even longer, and that would give you enough time to get to an emergency room. That would give you enough time to seek out help. You could go to the doctor and say, "Doctor, my heart has stopped. What should I do?" And he would then be able to have enough time to help you, because the critical problem today is that if you do have a heart attack, you don't have time. Everything's happening at once. There's no time to respond, no time to deal with it. If you can buy an hour, then suddenly that becomes a treatable condition that can be dealt with effectively. And that's simply one of the things on the horizon.
Well, Michael, do you see a situation where, I've got the respirocytes in my body and my heart has stopped? I mean, do I go to the doctor at the hospital, or do I consult the onboard AI doctor that I have? How does this all play together?
Well, hopefully the latter, I guess, but I think you're trying to create a connection between the two. It seems likely, clearly, it seems as if it might be, or most certainly be necessary for AI to come into play in coordinating large swarms of nanobots inside the body, clearly. And a lot of work's been done on that by people associated with the Foresight Institute. And even today, we see this movement called the quantified self, where people are starting to measure, quantify all sorts of aspects about their personal health and body and habits and all of the above, and basically publishing this online and allowing people to have information that might help them with specific like diseases or disabilities or the like. So I think we're going to see right now that's kind of just barely scratching the surface of its potential. We're going to see that happening a lot more frequently, where people don't even need to observe themselves and write down these quantitative things, because there'll be AIs, or I guess you could call it software, that is obviously a blur between the two, constantly sending information to centralized databases, where people will have the ability to set privacy settings like they do on Facebook now. It's like, I want to show my pictures of me at a party? And in the future, it'll be like, do I want people to know about my blood sugar level or like other metrics that are important for the human body? So I think that just through that massive amount of information, it'll allow us to cut through a lot of the sort of like stagnant portions of medical science as it is today. And what we'll start seeing is more of what's called like a citizen scientist, where not only scientists will be contributing the data and theory and analysis for moving forward on these areas, but we'll also see individuals submitting huge amounts of data, and that will greatly expand what scientists have to work with and also what the public has to consult on. So I think that's where AI will play a strong role.
So those are some interesting possibilities. Well, speaking of interesting possibilities, let's switch gears just slightly, and let's talk a little bit about what we'll be hearing from the two of you at the conference. And Michael, we'll start with you if you want to give us just a feel. Obviously we don't have time to get your whole talk, but just a little feel for what you're going to be addressing at the Foresight 2010 conference.
Well, the main thing I'm going to be addressing is the issue of anthropomorphism and artificial intelligence, where we have this history of almost half a century or greater than half a century of science fiction has focused on artificial intelligences. And you can even see, like in some of the old comics where robots take over the world, there's one picture I saw yesterday where the robot actually was hanging a man. Like, it was showed a man hung on a tree in the background, and he was like, the robot was sticking its metallic arm out towards a scantily clad woman, you know? And I'm just like, wow, that's so ridiculous. Why would a robot be sexually attracted to a human woman? It's because humans have a tendency to expect any entity to be a lot like them. So if you Google the term human universals, you'll see this list of about 100 or 200 characteristics that are considered by ethnographers and others to be pretty much common to all humans, like beliefs about death, magic to increase life, magic to sustain life, poetry, division of labor, divination, on and on. And all of these tendencies that human beings have been revealed to be, for the most part, sort of like solutions to evolutionary challenges, or we've seen that they are implemented by complex neurological underpinnings. They don't come out of nowhere. So say we created an intelligent machine from scratch, the first thing that people tend to assume is that, oh, it will definitely need to have a notion of the difference between good and evil, because any sufficiently intelligent being would figure that out. And what I'm going to be arguing about is that a lot of these notions that humans take for granted because we all share them in common will not necessarily emerge in artificial intelligences unless we explicitly program them in. So we might see scenarios where, for instance, we write a chess-playing robot that is as smart as possible and it starts to behave in ways that we don't anticipate. For instance, it might hack the channel that it's using to play with someone else online and cheat. And it wouldn't necessarily need to be like malicious cheating in the way that humans cheat. It would just be trying to win the game. So what we're going to start to see as we get more and more advanced artificial intelligences, we'll see that they don't necessarily adhere to what we consider human common sense, and that lots of the traits in humans that we take for granted are extremely complex, not really completely, we don't understand these traits well enough to write them down in code by any means. Like for dreaming, for instance, emotions, it's more likely that we'll probably create a stripped-down intelligence that lacks a lot of these unique human traits. I think that has a lot of implications for the way that we consider AIs to be a risk or a benefit in the future and the way that we develop AI as we move towards human equivalent intelligence. And I think it's important to understand these points and not to anthropomorphize AI, because when we do actually create human equivalent or human surpassing AI, it will have great capability of doing good or evil. And I would hope that we understand it well by that point. But given the way that I see a lot of people approaching AI today, they tend to approach it from a science fiction perspective. And I don't think that's useful. And I think that there's scientific evidence that can be presented that shows why that's incorrect.
There's even a maybe more primal response that people have to these machines. I referenced a talk that Jaime Cascio gave a few weeks ago. Actually, I guess a few months back. It was at the same time as the Singularity Summit. And one of the things he talked about in there was the kind of evolving human-to-machine empathy that you see. Troops in Afghanistan who become kind of emotionally attached to their bomb-sniffing robot, right, that gets blown up, and then they want the same one back that they had before. They don't want to get a new one. They want the one they had before because they've bonded with it. They've become emotionally attached. And Jaime shows this video of this, I think it's MIT, where they've created this walking robot, looks like a big dog, and the guy kicks it to show how it can regain its balance. And there's this funny moment where you go, oh man, you shouldn't kick that poor, you know, it's like this moment of sympathy or empathy that you immediately have. So it seems to me that there's this line, because as the intelligence comes online with potentially rights and thoughts and feelings that we want to be able to empathize with them, but we want to be careful that we're not reading something into it that isn't actually there.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, Ralph, what are we gonna be hearing from you about at the conference?
Well, one of the things people have always been talking about on molecular nanotechnology and nanofactories is all the marvelous things we can do. So there's a whole litany. I mean, basically, if you look, it's going to transform our material world. And then the obvious question is, okay, it's going to transform our material world. How do we do this? What are the steps that are required? And in particular, if you're going to be able to build all of these structures, how are you going to do it? What are the tools going to look like? How are you going to be able to do this economically? All of those sort of pragmatic questions. So I'll be looking at, in particular, some research in what's called mechanosynthesis. And mechanosynthesis basically is, what do molecular tools look like? what would be a set of molecular tools, and we actually have some very specific proposals for what molecular tools might look like and what you could build with them and exactly what chemical reactions are going to take place to allow you to build these complex, atomically precise molecular structures. And not only what do they look like, how do we go about developing this, how do we make all of this happen? And that's an area which I think is very important and one which I've been very interested in for some time. So we're now endeavoring to move that forward. I think one of the things you briefly mentioned when you were introducing me was the Nanofactory Collaboration. So anyone who wants to can go to the Nanofactory Collaboration website and look at sort of the goals and objectives and the discussion of the particular mechanisms by which we're going to go ahead and make all of this happen. And that seems to be a very useful thing to do at this point.
Well, we have one vote in the chat room for nanofactories that can replicate anything, especially chocolate. So as soon as we can make that happen, that sounds like one vote for that. Now, when you talk about mechanosynthesis, is it fair to say that what you're talking about developing there is, in a sense, it's the machine tools? These are the tools that would then be used to build the tools, to build the factories, to kind of it's kind of the basic infrastructure tools. Is that right?
You got it. Well, think of it this way. Suppose we started out 10,000 years ago and there's someone who's, you know, doesn't have our modern civilization available. How do they bootstrap this whole thing up? How do you build the tools to build the tools to build the tools? And how do you define all of these devices that you need? How do you clarify the target, the goals, the objectives? What are the systems going to look like? How are you going to make this happen? And that's one of the things we did. We actually did a lot of computational work. It turns out there's a very interesting fact. And the interesting fact is that today we have enough computer power and good enough computational chemistry programs that we can build molecular structures on the computer and figure out whether they work or not before, well before in some cases, we'll be able to build them in the physical world. So one of the things we can do is actually model the devices, whether it's a tool, a bearing, a gear, or some other fundamental device, we can actually analyze them and model them on a computer and have high confidence that if we built the device, it would behave in the way that we're describing. And this allows us to use the computer as sort of a way of looking into the future, of seeing the kinds of technologies that are going to be available, and of charting out the pathways to develop these technologies. So heavy use of computational technology to lay out not only the long-term sort of picture of what it is we're building, but also the steps by which we get there and to figure out what it is we're doing. And we've actually published some work on that people might find that interesting if you have a bit of a technical bent.
Well, you're modeling, nanotech on the computers. I wonder if our ability to write integrated circuits, now these features are getting down into the nano level, if our abilities to do that as they improve will actually contribute also to the development of nanotech in the physical world.
Another area of lively debate, obviously lithography, optical lithography, excuse me, optical lithography is a technology which is going to run into its limits, and people are trying to push beyond those limits right now. There's a lot of talk about using either immersion lithography. As you might know, light has a shorter wavelength when it's underwater. So if you put your lithographic apparatus underwater, then the wavelength of light shrinks and you can make smaller lines. So there are people who are looking into this. There's also discussion of extreme ultraviolet, which is very short wavelength light, and there are various problems with that look like they can reasonably be overcome. And as you keep shrinking it down, you know, the question becomes, can you use lithography to build things that are atomically precise? So far, the answer is no. So far, the answer is if you wish to build something that's atomically precise, you should either use self-assembly, which, of course, is the kind of technology that's been extensively used in biological systems by Mother Nature, or alternatively, you should use some sort of scanning probe technology. Scanning probe technologies have demonstrated ability in rather limited circumstances to arrange individual atoms in very precise patterns, usually a corporate or organizational logo, in order to demonstrate the remarkable capabilities of the particular laboratory carrying out the demonstration. So those two approaches look like they are effective ways of building things that are atomically precise, and then you have to start looking at that and saying, okay, given that those capabilities exist, how do we progress from there? How do we sort of sketch out the direction which would let us advance towards these more ambitious goals?
Ralph, do you think that the because I see the big advantage to modeling is that you're able to in that virtual environment, you're able to save time and money, and it's tremendously simpler to model things than it is to actually try to build them. So if you're going through a trial and error process, obviously you shortcut that significantly by putting models together, particularly when you have high confidence that the models are accurate. But do we run into a situation where we're going to have models down to the nanofactory level, where we're going to have the blueprint for the whole thing working online, but there's still a significant lag time to the physical production of these goods? And if so, how long of a lag do you think that will be? Are we talking decades between the two, or years, or months, or weeks? What does that look like?
Well, so far there's no major risk. So far it looks as though the level of resources that are being devoted to the design and analysis of nanofactories and molecular manufacturing is, I think, way, way, way below the level that would be appropriate given the value of the objectives. So I really don't think that's a major concern right now. I think the question you're asking is how long will it be before we have sort of the physical basis? That's always a little bit tricky to answer, but I can point out that there has been research. If you look at the sort of the positional assembly path, if you regard the scanning probe microscopes and the devices that position individual atoms and molecules as sort of a key enabler, then we can say that right now people are able to arrange hundreds of atoms on a surface, and over the next 5 or 10 years, I would expect that capability will move into three dimensions. So I would expect somewhere in that time frame we would see some significant advances in our ability to build small but very precise structures using that approach. And of course, there's the whole technique of using self-assembly. Self-assembly is a demonstrated technology. There are a number of people who are working on DNA self-assembly now who have found a number of excellent techniques for building complex molecular structures by simply pouring snippets of DNA into a test tube and stirring, and the DNA sort of shapes itself into some complex and desired shape. Now, that's only been developed, I think, in the past few years, so we're still seeing exactly how far that technology can be pushed and exactly what capabilities might be developed that prove to be useful and valuable. But that's another area where people are having a lot of interest in achieving a lot of success.
Michael, you said earlier that you foresee these technologies, and what you mean by that, I'm sure, is like artificial general intelligence and truly spooky nanotech. We're talking 20 years off still yet. Is the problem that we still have to build the tools to build the tools, and we're just several generations away from that, or how do you see this?
Yeah, we are currently putting a lot of effort into building the tools. For instance, sort of molecular modeling software that Ralph is talking about. I mean, we've moved around atoms on a surface, like we've moved silicon atoms on a surface at room temperature. That's the group that did that was awarded the Forsyth Institute's Feynman Prize in 2009. But this is sort of like the equivalent of the sort of like a Stone Age manufacturing, like pushing together sticks and tying them together with leather and the like. We haven't really made the toolkit that we need to even begin designing an ant factory. I think that Ralph and Rob Freitas have done great work by characterizing the precise reactions that would take place at a mechanosynthetic tooltip, but it's still early steps, and I don't think that necessarily means that it's certain to be more than a few decades away. I think that if progress does begin moving a little faster, then it could start folding in on itself and creating a feedback effect. But a lot of the projections for when sophisticated nanotechnology would come to pass have, in my view anyway, been excessively optimistic. And I remember hearing in maybe 1995 that it was plausible that nanotech could come about within 20 years. And I think one of the reasons why people are sometimes a little over-optimistic is that there's the assumption that people will come around and see the value of sophisticated molecular nanotechnology. And it does have a tremendous amount of value, as Ralph is saying about being able to hold your breath upon the pool or surviving a heart attack, not dying for an hour, the like. And even more than those computer and medical applications, we could also create huge quantities of everyday objects. That's one of the most fascinating applications of advanced nanotechnology to me, would be the notion that if you have more robotic arms working at a smaller level, you could pack more functionality and productivity into the same unit volume. So a nanofactory that uses quadrillions of robotic nano arms to manipulate carbon atoms can be much, much more productive than a, for instance, a product assembled by several macro-scale robotic arms. So what we could see is like maybe 100 or even 1,000 times speed up in like factory productivity once we are able to design products that can be fabricated by these nanofactories. So the benefits, as Ralph said, you could go on and on all day about them because they're so huge. But the thing that's been somewhat discouraging to me is that we've seen these benefits being discussed widely. We've seen them gaining a lot of attention, especially in Kurzweil's work, but yet we haven't seen that corresponding increase in research interest in like the fundamentals that are necessary to move it forward, like diamondoid mechanosynthesis. And there's not even any agreement on which path will be easiest to build up the toolkit that we're looking for. There's Rob and Ralph's perspective, which is the dry route, and on the other side, Eric Drexler believes that using full, spontaneously assembling protein molecules would be a faster route. So we really seems like we're kind of in the early stages. That's why I say that I don't think that sophisticated nanotechnology would come about the next 20 years, but it's still possible, and you never really know. But I'd encourage everyone to check out crnnano.org because that's a site that gives a good summary of the throughput magnification capabilities that nanotech could offer, and goes into a lot of the sort of, along with nanofactory collaboration, goes into some of the technical details and clearly states the implications, not in sort of like a journalistic narrative, which is where we see a lot of these articles in popular press, where it kind of frames it as a story. I think what's needed is more non-sensationalistic, straightforward discussion, almost like an academic, you could say boring, in quotes, discussion of the possible implications. And we're starting to see more academic attention on that, but we're not seeing too much increasing scientific attention on the some of the prerequisite technologies like building the toolbox. Some of the interesting work that's been done in this area a lot, which has gotten some mainstream coverage, has been done by Ned Seaman, who is a nanotechnologist that focuses on using DNA as a building block. And you can tell that his work is really important because it's interesting. He gave a talk at the Singularity Summit, and out of all the talks, he was one of the few people that requested that his not be put online because he's working on such cutting-edge stuff that he, you know, doesn't want other people to get too many ideas and race ahead of him. So I think that's interesting, but all these areas are extremely unpredictable, and we just have to keep our heads to the ground, basically, and listen carefully for progress in one area or another. And I think it's difficult to say, you know, how far we are, but I do think that we do not have the tools right now, and we need at least one or two other generations of tool building before we get to a point where we can start making effort towards a true molecular assembler.
Okay, fair enough.
I'd like to add to that before we go on, which is that I think basically we don't see a focused effort to develop molecular manufacturing. And I think really one of the things people talk about how long it will take, that depends on what we do and how much work we put into it. I think pretty clearly if we have a focused and a well-funded effort that has full resources, then we can achieve the objective much more rapidly. If we don't have any focused effort and don't pursue it, then it will take longer. If you want to go to the moon, you have to have a focused project. That's what happened when we actually landed on the moon. And if you haven't got such a focused effort, you're probably not going to achieve the objective anytime soon.
Well, there it is. I think we're going to have to leave it with that thought. We will hopefully pick this up next week and talk about additional reasons why people need to take interest in this and why there needs to be a concerted effort towards nanotechnology. And artificial intelligence. I got to tell you guys, we've got a terrific discussion going on in the chat room. More questions than we would have time for. And I know Stephen, you had another interesting kind of a teaser question that you wanted to throw out, and we've just simply, quite simply, run out of time. Too many good ideas in too little time this evening. Well, I just want to thank both of you for being with us. Michael, always a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for being with us. We hope to have you on again sometime after the conference, and maybe we can do a debrief with you then.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And Ralph, glad we finally got you on. We were actually hoping to have you on last summer when we were doing our special series, The World Transformed. We did a show about cryonics, and we wanted to get your views on that.
Cool.
So I'm hoping that sometime we'll have you back on, and we'll do a whole show dedicated just to that topic.
That sounds fine.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for being on the program. Once again, everyone, please follow the links. Please consider attending Foresight 2010. It will be well worth your while. Stephen, tell us about our music this evening.
The song is Beautiful Girl by Joe Coolidge.
Beautiful Girl by Joe Coolidge. Now, this is the same Beautiful Girl that Van Halen did back in the 70s. No.
I don't think it's a cover. I think this is original music. Now, Joe Coolidge is the one who did the Shambhala cover a few weeks ago on the show. So we know we enjoyed him on that song. So here he's back singing Beautiful Girl.
Joe Coolidge with Beautiful Girl. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen, for all you do on the program. Sally, thank you to you and all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and everyone listening to us via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again next week when our special guests will be Brian Wong and Robin Hansen. Until then, live to see it.
Dream of the way like a snake.